Welcome to the Tomorrow Brands podcast, where we ask a series of experts what makes a brand of tomorrow. I'm your host, Ruth Vitok, Managing Partner at Tomorrow Brands, a consultancy that helps international brands launch and scale in the UK. Today I'm joined by Claire Cherry. Claire is a partner at ERA, a leading consumer VC fund. She has over a decade of experience investing and scaling disruptive, high-growth brands across the consumer sector, from pre-seed to Series A. Today, we lift the lid on what VCs look for from brands before they invest and get Claire's perspective on the categories, trends and brands to watch this year. Hope you enjoy. Hi, Claire. Thanks for joining us today. Really excited for this chat. First, it would be great to hear a bit about your background, how you got into investing and why.
Yeah, of course. Lovely to be here with you. So yeah, I've got to be honest, I totally fell into investing, really. So when I graduated, I took a 6-week internship. And really, that turned out to be a venture fund. I think for me, at the beginning, I invested in everything from pensions administration software to cancer drugs to Mexican restaurants, you name it, we saw it. But really, I always loved the consumer space. I think from that perspective, yeah, right from the beginning, I was always drawn to that much more than the B2B side of things. I guess I've been doing it ever since. I joined ERA as a partner last year, and really our thesis here is to back category transforming consumer brands, predominantly across fast moving consumer goods, right? So beauty, personal care, future of food, wellness and longevity probably encompass a good chunk of it. The fund is Australian by background. The founding team built and sold one of the leading supplements brands out there and really wanted to take their learnings and network and bring it to life to support kind of other consumer founders. So sweet spot for us is anywhere from probably 1 to 10 million of revenue, generally omni-channel businesses, great presence in retail, and we help them grow and scale into category leaders. So yeah, we've been privileged to back some amazing brands like Seed in the prebiotic space, Jinx in pet food, and Conserving Beauty is a waterless beauty brand. So that's a potted summary of me and where we are.
Nice. And you guys, it's not just UK, right? Or Australian brands, you look...
Yeah, so it's everywhere. A pretty global remit. I'd say most of what we see is predominantly across Europe, Australia and North America. So at the moment, probably half the fund is in North American businesses and then the rest split between the other markets. And yeah, we do a lot of international expansion and helping companies drive to new markets.
And so I'm going to ask you a few questions today about kind of from a brand perspective of what brands should think about when they're looking to raise or thinking about working with a VC. So what do you guys look for when you choose to invest in a brand?
Yeah, so for us, I think given the background and where we've come from, we probably are slightly different to a number of other venture funds. And also every venture fund has different ideas about what they like and what they want to see. But we certainly appreciate here that building brands takes a long time, right? So we're expecting brands to outlast our legacy and our part of their journey. And that will always take longer than as much any founder thinks, any investor thinks. But fundamentally, we are people first, right? Even at the size that we're talking about, founders are still very important. Our portfolio founders are a group of amazing people who are truly passionate about the areas in which they're building. And that kind of sees you through the good times and the bad, right? Of which there will be many in quick succession. And yeah, they'll pretty much do anything to make their vision a reality. And that's a very powerful thing. And then I think from our perspective, the reality of consumer investing, it has to come down to the physical product, right? Is the product amazing? Does it truly stand out in every respect, right? Whether that's packaging, branding, what sits underneath the hood. Really, that's what keeps consumers coming back, keeps retail buyers getting excited and allows you to cut through. So yeah, fundamentally, we are product people at the end of the day. We like to touch and feel things and see where they are in the wild as well. I think the final point probably that I guess some people maybe didn't focus on for a few years, but for us is super important, is the potential to sit offline in physical retail, right? It's still the bulk of purchases, and executing on this is completely different to how you show up from a digital perspective. And as much as I'd like to say otherwise, you can't really mess it up, right? You get one shot with retailers, you get one shot with buyers. And so from that side, yeah, it's very important to us and important as to how founders think about it. And obviously this all shows up in the financials, the nitty gritty, but really for us, it's those areas that then feed into kind of a sustainable business.
It's really interesting, isn't it, with like bricks and mortar retail, because there was that period during COVID where it was like, oh, it's over. It's all digital now. It's all D2C. D2C is booming, new normal. And actually, it's not. Still the most important channel. And I think you're right about you only get one shot. And I think for brands, getting the timing of that is so important. Like, it is very possible to go too early. And you've probably seen, I've seen examples of brands who've done that, and then it's catastrophic. So having the resources in place to make sure that if you do land one of those listings, that you can firstly supply it, but secondly support it. It's one thing getting into Tesco. It's quite another thing getting people to buy it from Tesco. And I think the timing of that is critical. And so,
wild, right? It's amazing to have that kind of opening purchase order, but really that's where the hard work begins. And also, I think particularly now, some of the bigger retailers, both here and in the US, are really driving that innovation agenda, right? And that means they're going earlier, they're looking for earlier stage brands, but they're almost certainly not ready. And equally, if you pick the wrong partner, then it's completely catastrophic for the business. So, and I think, and it's hard to say no, for sure. I understand that. And I understand that when you see a nice, big, shiny number in front of you, it puts you in a very difficult position. But that's a fundamental part, for us in terms of thinking about that.
I remember a brand I worked with, we literally were trying to avoid one of the UK's biggest retailers because we knew that we weren't ready mostly from a sort of operations perspective, that we wouldn't be able to put. So the phone would ring and it'd be, pretend I'm out. Like, we can't talk to them. We do really want to do it, but we just know we can't do it yet. And it's very hard to say no to these people. So let's just try and sit down the curb.
Yeah, completely. And also, it's about positioning, right? I think the other piece is that people maybe who haven't had experience in that area before, perhaps just think all listings are created equal, which obviously we know is entirely not the case. So yeah, it's a very fickle area for sure.
And it's interesting with founders, isn't it? Because you need to have, I think, a little bit of naivety, because if you knew too much, you probably would never do it. Because it's like you say, it takes a long time. I don't think there's any such thing as overnight success in FMC. It's a slog and it's a roller coaster. But also that having that experience and that sort of specific knowledge. And for me, I think a really great founder knows their own gaps and plugs in the right talent to fill them. So it's that trying to find someone who's got that mix of enthusiasm and naivety and the sort of, they're going to have persevere and go the distance. But also, there is a lot of very specific knowledge required in FMCG, especially when it comes to retailers and the differences between them, and being aware of your own gaps of knowledge too is really important.
Yeah, and I think it's about also appreciating, particularly if you're a solo founder, how you build out that group of trusted people around you. And that doesn't necessarily have to be from a formal C-suite capacity, right? I think the best founders that we know always surround themselves with people that have that ability truly to give trusted advice on all the areas that they perhaps aren't top of their mind in terms of their skill set historically. But that also takes a certain type of person, right? We've seen it the other way where the advice you get is wrong and then that's just as bad, right? So it's a very tumultuous time, I think, to start with for all of these early brands.
It is. And also, you can give advice and someone who's worked in the industry a long time, but things are always changing as well. And there's also always brands that buck the trend or don't do what you think they're going to do. So there's also a little bit of luck, a little bit of timing. Yeah. And then the opposite side of that. So what are the sort of red flags or put-offs that you come across?
I think for us, probably there's two core buckets that we see quite frequently. The first is a belief that if I give you investment, then you can spend that on Facebook and all of your problems will go away, which obviously, as we know, and anyone particularly who's worn a marketing hat at any point understands, right? It's just not the way of the world these days. And yes, as you say, there might be outliers who scaled on TikTok very efficiently, scaled on Meta still efficiently, but generally it's the one in a blue moon, right? And I think for us, we speak quite a lot to founders about how they think about scaling that marketing funnel beyond the channels that are working today, right? Because ultimately, taking your business to the next level is very different probably from where you've come historically. And I get when capital is scarce and there's a thousand things on your plate, then it's hard to prioritize SEO or longer term channels that don't have an immediate payback. But for us, that's a as important part of the equation. And equally, even if you do see success on Meta, it's those that then become so dependent and don't really know where to turn after that. And I think, look, there is a whole group of people that would be happy investing in kind of Facebook first brands. But for us, it's about what is underneath the surface. If you turn off that marketing funnel, are people coming back? Is there customer love? You know, all of those underlying pieces that can get hidden in the noise of someone who's very good at growth marketing.
Music to my ears, to be honest, because I'm such a believer in like long-term, that's the sort of the long and short of it, the long-term brand building, not just the short-term performance marketing. And again, with the boom in D2C, everything's flipped that way for a while. And as a marketer, it's quite depressing, but it's definitely coming back round. I think people have seen the consequences of that. So it's much easier now to make the argument that you need to be doing both.
And I think, yeah, people looked at me like I was crazy, the same as you, right? Probably in the middle of it where I was like, oh, we still care about retail. We still care about other channels. You know, we don't truly do influencer brands, I guess, for an easier way to describe it. So yeah, that's been, I think, an education for a lot of people. And it's hard because you do see success stories and people that make it look easy and ultimately may get to acquisition. But for us, that's just not the type of business that we want to see or we want to back. And then I think the second is really around gross margins, product margins, and ultimately perhaps an assumption, as you say, from founders' naivety in some respects that truly will maybe even double over time, which I think from anyone who's been around a real business that sells actual product, truly how difficult that is. And that for us, it just makes your life much more difficult, right? If your margin structure is not there from the beginning, then very, very difficult to sort out in future.
Yeah. I think I just want to say as well, naivety can be a good thing. It can be like a you need a little bit of it. It's the same as like hope and optimism. But someone said to me that what gets you, there's sort of £7 million split. So what gets you to 1 million will then not get you to 7, will not get you to 14. Those are big turning points for a business, which I thought was interesting. So I think that kind of online hypey brand that might get you to a certain point. But if you want to then get to that next stage, you're going to have to do different things and actually generally start looking at those more traditional FMCGs. And yeah, but for the brands that don't, it's like it's the exception, not the rule.
Yeah, absolutely. And I completely agree. I think, yeah, whether you call it 5 or 7, 10 or 15, ultimately, yeah, there are big hurdles. And I think the other piece is that there are big hurdles even at 30 or 50 and ceilings of how you think and just the expectation that people have on you in terms of everything from customer service to buyer and retailer relationships. The whole playbook, as you say, is flipped on its head probably 3 or 4 times before you've even got to mediocre scale. So from that perspective, yeah, it's a lot. I think a big piece of what we do is try and help founders along that journey, particularly from a team perspective, from building out, yes, you hope your team has flexibility and resilience and an ability to scale, but equally, again, the structures fundamentally look very different for those stages of business.
And what do you think founders need to be mindful of when they start to think about taking on VC investment?
The fundamental reality really is that VC has been glamorized a lot in the media, right? Both in terms of how founders speak about it, how funds speak about it. And I mean, it's just not the route for everyone. And it's probably not the route for 80 or 90% of founders. And I get that really it comes back to what are you building this for? What is your passion? What is success for you as a person? Because ultimately, VC is only one route to a potential successful outcome. And I think the founders that do well with VC funding truly accept that once you start, you're on the treadmill forever, right? There is no other route until exit. And I think that takes a specific type of person who is okay pretty much constantly fundraising, probably for a good 5 to 10 years of their life. And equally, look, whether it's VC, personal, family office, angels, not all money is created equal, right? So from that perspective, and from my view, it's about alignment with what you want to achieve. So you should ultimately build a group of people around you, of which some of those are investors that truly believe in your vision and where you want to take it and the time frame for that and the scale. And I speak to a lot of amazing founders that I'm like, look, I truly believe in what you're doing, but it's just not a venture model. And that's fine. That shouldn't be seen as a bad thing. And if anything, it should be seen as an amazing thing. And I get that pools of capital are harder to access outside of VCs and maybe not so well publicized, but that's all changing. And so for me, it's that alignment piece, right? And also what you as a founder are looking for. If you want hands-on advice, guidance, someone to call, then it's probably not a VC. Ultimately, they have a portfolio of brands and we'll be there and we try and help our founders whenever they need it. But, you know, it's never going to be as involved as, say, true non-exec directors or exec directors, right? And that's the reality of it.
It's a very long-term partnership, right?
For me, it's as long as a marriage in many respects. And also, it is about fundamentally understanding what you both want as partners to this. I do say to founders that as much as it's very hard, same as the retailers, to say no to checks, to say no to cash, it's not just a check you'll never hear from these people, right? It's something that will sit with you for at least 3 years, if not a lot longer. Therefore, you have to know and understand those people as much as they know and understand you. That feels hard for some founders to ask and to truly dig deeper on those relationships.
There's no such thing as a free lunch.
Exactly.
Any other advice for brands starting out and starting to think about raising?
I think, again, it is a very personal journey, right? So I think before you get into the hubris of what are people telling you or what advice are you getting, what is success for you as a founder? Why are you doing this? Why are you going through all of the joy and pain and everything and the roller coaster of this? And what does success look like? And that is very different from every single founder, right? But I think some people, you can feel that they say what they think they should be saying or what they've been told to say, but actually you just won't succeed, right? It's the passion, it's the drive. And for most of these people, the funding is a kind of second avenue to that, right? It's not truly, particularly in consumer, very few people sit here and say, oh, I just want to raise this big funding round. They appreciate that really what drives it is what's going on underneath. And also don't be ashamed that if you don't take VC funding or you don't want to take VC funding or your growth is a different trajectory. There's no right or wrong, right? There is many ways to get to a successful outcome.
And I think setting out with, I've heard actually of people wanting to be a founder to want to be a founder, if that makes sense. And it's such a tough slog, really, to build something big. I think anyone who's built a business and sold it would say that. If you don't have that passion, that real belief in what you're doing, it's going to be very difficult to stay the course, because the amount of hard days or things going wrong, if you're in it for the wrong reasons, yeah, that it's tough, isn't it? You've got to have something, I think, that's driving you, that's not just, you're not going to make a quick buck. I think that's the reality.
Yeah, exactly. And also, you have to have your own North Star, right, in terms of why do you do it? And I think the same is also true for us on the other side as investors. I have to sit and say, why do I do this? Why do I get up every day? And it's not to say I'm a VC. It's because I truly believe in the businesses that we're backing and putting amazing products into people's hands. And I think that, yeah, you can forget on both sides of the fence, yeah, where you sit and really what that end goal is.
So that leads us on quite nicely to thinking more about brands and categories. What do you think are the most exciting categories at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two for us that probably pop up quite frequently. And I think we're quite excited about how that transition works over the next few years. The first is, and it sounds quite broad, but really the evolution of how people consume food, right? So we're at a massive inflection point of a lot of people taking GLP-1s in the US, navigating the backlash against ultra-processed food, changing mindsets around protein, fat, sugar. There's narrative everywhere you look on this. And I think for us, it does create an environment for challenger brands to succeed, right? I think how people think about what they're consuming. They care about ingredients, labels, I guess similar to probably what we saw in skincare 5-10 years ago, right? It feels like food is really having a transitional moment. And I guess it's not a category that we'd particularly seen that much innovation in historically, but it's definitely coming. And obviously food and beverage, I should say, come under the same remit there. And then the second also ties into that, but is probably around the intersection of people trying to wean themselves off pharma-based solutions. So whether that's pain management, whether that's longevity, you know, all of that kind of living healthier, longer lives, right? So if we look at longevity as an example, historically, really it's been clinic-based solutions for the 1%. And now we're starting to see all of that learning come into mass market propositions, accessible price points, mainstream consumerism. And yeah, for us, fantastic, right? It's exactly what we want to see. We want to back businesses that help people make better choices, accessible price points, right? And that feels like those areas are really coming to the fore now.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think it's really exciting. And I think the sort of turning away from big pharma one, especially interesting. And whether it's a sort of an education thing, you know, in the way we're sharing information and the communities that there are. I mean, I know there's a lot of kind of, especially around menopause now, there's big groups where people are trading information and sharing what's working for them. And also a sort of return to more traditional kind of home remedies as well. And there's something just really lovely in that. It's a sort of tincture that's been created, that's been handed down the generations. And I think there's something just, there's a really lovely story there that we all turned away from that sort of thing. And now there's a wisdom in that's being understood again. And we've seen quite a few brands in that space, very small for now, but feels like that's a trend that's going to start to lift some of them
yeah,
up.
Completely. Yeah, I completely agree. And ultimately, if you look historically, those kinds of products probably got a bad rep because maybe the efficacy wasn't there, whereas now ingredient quality is improved, efficacy is much better, and ultimately they are equivalent, right? And once you get to equivalence, of course you would take a natural remedy over something that you're being given from a prescription basis. And I think you're right, the information availability now is allowing people to take a lot more control and also a proactive approach to managing all of those areas of their lives, which historically, I guess, was much more a reactive proposition.
Yeah, and I guess there's an intersection there as well, isn't there? If you think about ginger, for example, as something that people have started to take as shots, and it ticks the box of it's this a more traditional remedy, there is clinical evidence around it, but also that non-UPF, what's going into your body. It's sort of I think where brands can sit at the intersection of trends is when you see really rapid growth. So if you're ticking the boxes on a few macro trends, you're going to see a lot of traction quite quickly.
Yeah, and it's interesting because at the start, even the way that we speak about the categories we invest in, right? Ultimately, it's the intersection of all three that are really where we're seeing the most growth. So whether it's functional mushrooms, whether it's supplements for women's health, but really the holistic food, wellness, tea, it all sits together. And I think you're entirely right.
We've talked about categories, but any specific brands that you'd say are ones to watch?
So I think there's a couple that we've seen recently that I'm interested to see where they get to. One is a business called Cuddle, which is a sleep health brand. So I think everyone is speaking about sleep. Everyone appreciates the importance of sleep, but ultimately most people have a terrible sleep routine. So they've launched a market with a kind of powder-based supplement for a pre-sleep drink. Tastes amazing. Brand looks great. No one's really truly owned that space apart from probably 8Sleep at a very different proposition and very different price point. Yeah, we love that as a space. We love that kind of building rituals and habits, right? Ultimately, it's a very powerful play and seems to be resonating super well with consumers. And then the second that I'm very interested to see, which is a skincare brand called All Golden. So it's targeting women who are 40 and up. It's a beautiful brand. They've nailed tone of voice. They have amazing products. And again, truly that area of the market hasn't been spoken to that well at all. And I think, you know, for us, there's, as much as everyone says skincare is very crowded or whatever, there's still pockets that, again, when you see it, it's a real visualization of what's been missing.
I couldn't agree more. I had the last episode of the podcast, we spoke to a trends forecaster and we talked about how 45 plus women have been completely ignored by brands. And actually, they've got much higher disposable income. They're responsible for over 90% of purchasing power in the household is coming from this audience group. And yet everyone's chasing the Gen Z pound. And they don't have many pounds for a start. No. There's this huge opportunity. And this audience is just not being spoken to properly. So I think it feels so obvious that will be something we'll start to see more and more of, this sort of brands that are coming out and speaking really specifically to this audience in a way. And, you know, they need to do their homework as well. I sent a deck for a sort of pre-launch brand that said they were talking to women of this age and everything was bubblegum pink. And please do something a little bit cleverer than that.
Yeah, and I think, it's the evolution of a lot of this, right? So obviously some brands went first in menopause and used that as their hook in. But then equally, menopause isn't a massively long period of that phase of your life, right? I mean, we're seeing a few and some interesting takes on it, but I think you're right. And I wish I had a pound for every time someone said, oh yeah, you know, I'm going to go onto TikTok. And I'm like, but your consumer squarely is 35 plus. I was like, what do you think is going to happen on there? That is generally more of a hustle, I think, to access these people. It's not as simple as Facebook groups or anything like that. Go out, meet people in person, do things offline, do activations, all of that piece that people seem to forget about for half a decade.
They're a lot savvier, that older group, and they're a lot, from some research that I've done for a couple of brands, they're not as susceptible to marketing. They're not as easily swayed. If you can win them in, then they're loyal. It's a massive prize. I heard someone describe it as a sort of, it's like the last unconquered territory in a sense. And I did also hear that apparently part of the problem is that there's just not that many people of that age who work in marketing. So for whatever reason, people drop out and it's a young person's game.
Yeah, that's an interesting take on it because, yeah, I'd never thought about it from that perspective, but you're probably right. And I think ultimately, but again, it's just the hype cycles, right? As soon as people have left Gen Z already, right? It's on to Gen Alpha. If I hear anything more about 12-year-olds buying skincare, I'm like, yes, but ultimately you're selling to their parents, right, at the end of the day. And also they are trading up generally to existing brands and it's a very different world. The legacy of we've always going to be going for younger and younger consumers, get them earlier, longer life, it just becomes so, so crowded at that end of the market and, yeah, everything else underserves.
And I also don't even really believe that it's true, right? Because you don't stay with brands your whole life. I look at my kids who are, I don't even know what gen they are, young, but they are the most fickle consumers you will ever meet. They're obsessed with something for a few weeks, the whole playground, they're all obsessed with it. And then they move on. And I actually said to my son the other day, I was like, are you all still into Prime? And they've moved on to sort of this pen brand. But you think that's how it works, isn't it? I just don't believe that you hook them young and you've got them forever anyway.
No, and I actually think if you look at even anyone who is older, right, brands have you kept virtually zero.
So a couple more questions. Favourite investment you've made?
Yeah, so ironically, actually, it comes to the point we spoke about before around older consumers. So I invested in a business called Jude, which is an incontinence brand. On the face of it, unsexy category, rife with taboo, perceived to be a small market, but it's Peony's passion, right? It drives her day in, day out. She will talk to anybody who will listen about incontinence and ultimately wants to change the lives of women. And I think seeing the evolution of that journey right from the very beginning, we knew Peony pre-launch all the way through to where she is today. And it's that drive, that ability to build a product that ultimately does do what it says it does, get retailers to believe in it and truly see the execution of that in real life, getting people into Covent Garden in a set of port-a-loos to show that there's not enough public toilets. You know, all of those pieces that ultimately, yeah, you have to do things that don't scale. You have to test it. And that was an amazing journey. And I think it's just the beginning for Peony and the team there. But yeah, it's a great business.
Also, in that, you are genuinely changing people's lives for the better. And that's really, I think, working in this business, in this industry, trying to work with brands who are doing some sort of good helps.
And it takes many forms. But if we look at all of the portfolio and the success, it ultimately comes down to exactly that, right? Whether it be We The Wild, who are taking toxins out of plant care in homes, or whether it be Seed, who said there's an opportunity to build the world's best pre and probiotic, and we are stand behind that. We're going to do a single SKU, right? Which everyone would have said that should not work. That is the biggest risk. But that was their belief. And ultimately, again, all of these changed lives for the better, which I think, yeah, you can't avoid that when you see what's been successful.
And is there one that got away?
It's always a painful question, that one. Yeah, I think the one I think about most, mainly because I saw it, but I couldn't convince people of it, which I guess is probably most painful. So we looked at a brand called Curlsmith, which is a textured hair care brand. This probably would have been 6 or 7 years ago. But even then, they had built the most unbelievable community. You could see it everywhere you looked. They co-developed the products, they co-developed the packaging. They were engaged and they loved it. And I saw it, but I couldn't convince people that there was something there. Because at the time, again, there was so much noise around social media and building communities on Instagram. And I guess you didn't have the metrics and the tracking that you have today. But yes, as we all know, it sold for a lot of money and I would probably be on a beach. Good thing for a lot of people, I'm not.
I'm also laughing because this morning I was in a conversation where Curlsmith came up in that sort of peer-to-peer recommendation, two ladies with curly hair, and one of them said, have you tried Curlsmith? And yeah, that's how those great brands build.
Yeah, well, and I think someone made a very good point to me, right? Where if you actually, like, we talk a lot about enabling word of mouth and referral programs, loyalty, irrelevant. For the brands that are genuinely doing something different, it is true word of mouth. You tell your friends, you tell anyone who will listen. And I think sometimes we forget that is a very difficult thing to achieve and very powerful once you have it.
It's also a very difficult thing to measure. How do you try and track that? You can't. And yet it's the most powerful thing in marketing, as we all know. Like, there's nothing more influential than a friend telling you about something. But as brands, occasionally you'll do a survey and say, how did you hear about it? And someone will tick the word of mouth box. But most people don't even know. It's just landed in their brain and they don't know how. So it's the sort of holy grail of marketing, but you can't force it and you can't track it.
Yeah, no, exactly. Which also means that from an investment perspective, it's very hard to work out exactly where it is. But I think you start to see some of the signs. Again, it comes back to that holistic view, right? If you're seeing, we actually looked at one in the apparel space in sportswear that is pre-launch, but I suspect it will do very well because I can see that they're building this groundswell that will enable people to talk about it wherever they go, whatever they do. And we actually invested in a business called Bandit that did it very well in running. The tangible community who spoke about the quality of the products, wore them all the time, told their friends, gifted. Yeah, that is, we try and we look at reviews and customer lifetime and all of that piece, which gives you an ability. And when you see it, you can see it in the data for sure, as long as you know where to look. But it is, yeah, the holy grail.
It's that sort of instincts, isn't it? And I think you only can develop those with experience as well. So if you've been in an industry a long time, you start to get the good gut feel about some brands versus others. And it's hard, I guess, when you're having to try and persuade people to put money into them.
Yeah, and I think it's different now. I mean, seeing how many that I've seen and we see as a fund, right, that we'd be hard pushed truly to see a product or a category that we didn't have quite a lot of data on already. And therefore, you do start to say, okay, this is exceptional. But some of them, I say generally, I would reach out to them, and the challenge is that they probably don't need money. Mm-hmm. They don't. And that's the irony now, right? Is that a lot of the best founders, and we talk about when you said people wanting VC funding, the challenge I think I'm going to have over the next 5 years is people not wanting VC funding, right? And what does that look like? And what do we offer to them that ultimately enables that door to be open? Because yeah, those are the brands that truly have that power.
So I'm going to finish off with a question that we're asking everybody, which is, what makes a brand of tomorrow, in your opinion?
So I've tried to fit it into one line, and I would say an unbelievable product underpinned by a customer-centric approach to market. That's what I've gone for.
Nailed it. Love it.
As you can see, we're product people, right? Yeah, for me, get that right and the rest falls into place.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Claire. That was really interesting chat. I loved it. Thank you.
No, thanks for having me, Ruth. It was a delight.